research shows that a lack of diversity in healthcare can create health disparities. Our next guest is working to shape the next generation of doctors in an effort to create a more diverse and inclusive environment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your doctor understands you and your background? Can they reach out and meet your needs? Do you see different groups represented in the healthcare profession? If you're a doctor yourself or looking to work in healthcare, do you see a diverse group of coworkers, of classmates along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Alex Porter is a neuro-oncologist at Mayo Clinic. She co-founded the nonprofit Elevate Med that works to increase physician workforce diversity and improve cultural competence among physicians. Dr. Porter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's just a privilege to be here.
Well, let's start by talking about your own experience as a Black woman in medicine. Now, if we surveyed all the Black women who work as neuro-oncologists in this country, one in four of them are you. There's only four, literally. Could you talk about that?
It's true. It's true. And at 45 years old, I'm the most senior, which is even an even more startling statistic. You know, when I entered medical school, I thought potentially I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, having been inspired by the career of Dr. Ben Carson. It was only later that I figured out that neurology was actually the right field for me. And when I went to my counselor in medical school and said, I found it, I figured out what I want to be, it's neurology. He said, well, Alex, you don't look like a neurologist. And while I made a joke at the time and said, well, let me grab my bow tie and make us all feel really comfortable about this, he really wasn't wrong. Less than 1% of neurologists are Black, and even less so Black women. And so I am breaking barriers along the way, I'll say, in my career. And in many ways, it's quite a privilege.
We'll talk more about that path to becoming a doctor and a specialist in different areas in a bit. I want to talk about the idea of health equity a little bit, though. On the patient side of things, what does health equity mean?
It means that patients should be able to expect to receive the same treatment for the same disease and expect the same outcome as a result of that treatment. And one of the reasons why it's so is such an important aspect of the conversation when we start to talk about workforce diversity is that we all have a moral obligation to put an end to health disparities. And there's so many reasons why different populations may have different outcomes or may receive different treatments. But one of the aspects that's tangible in that complexity is influencing the workforce. And that's why I've spent so much of my career investing in the next generation, because we know that when we enter into the healthcare system, it's at a time that we are at our most vulnerable. And that is where we deserve to feel like we belong and that we can trust in the people that are providing the care for us. And there's no greater way to establish trust and that sense of belonging than through representation. And that's why it is so critically important that the healthcare workforce, physicians included, reflect the populations that we're caring for.
You've got this nonprofit you started with your husband, I understand. It's called Elevate Med, which is a lot of what we're talking about here. Can you talk about Elevate Med and the mission?
Absolutely. My husband, Dr. Gregory Umphrey, and I, we come from families that are emotionally supportive, but financially less so. And by the time we got together in residency and talked about what it might look like for us to get married, we quickly realized that together we owed over $500,000 in medical school debt alone. Both of us were privileged to have full scholarships for undergrad, but had to take out a combination of private and federal loans in order to make our medical school dreams a reality. And so what we created with Elevate Med is a gap that I saw in our medical school experience. I wish that there were scholarships for folks like me that are looking to really become leaders in healthcare and to influence healthcare, health policy, and all of those things. I wish that I had mentors that looked like me doing what I do. I wish that I had some form of leadership development, because physicians really are leaders in whatever spaces they hold. And that's a critically important component to our success in our careers. And then finally, I wish that we had some elements of financial wellness education. We know that folks that are coming from underrepresented backgrounds often have higher levels of indebtedness coming from undergrad as well as medical school. Unfortunately, the data would also suggest that women and people of color often get paid less, even within medicine, than their white counterparts. When it comes to the research spectrum, unfortunately, we also know that data shows us that our research is less likely to be funded. And I start to think about what questions are out there that are left unanswered because the funding never came through. And so having the scholarships, the mentorship, the leadership development, and the financial wellness education are the four pillars of our Elevate Med program. And I'm so grateful to share with you, Rob, that in the last coming up on 4 years since our inception, we've already been able to award over $500,000 in scholarships and support. But for our program to continue to be as successful as it is, it really does depend on folks continuing to invest invest in us. And so anybody listening today who's interested can find us at elevatemed.org. And please help us by making a donation to our program.
We're talking to Dr. Alex Porter, neuro-oncologist at Mayo Clinic, about her work to increase diversity among doctors. If you have a question about her work or a personal experience to share, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Dr. Alex Porter is with us, neuro-oncologist at Mayo Clinic, talking about her work to increase physician workforce diversity and to improve cultural competence among physicians. She co-founded the nonprofit Elevate Med. Dr. Porter, you mentioned the importance of mentorship. That's part of what you're trying to do. In your situation coming into neuro-oncology, if you wanted to talk to a Black woman in the field, I'm guessing the number was zero or really close to it when you were coming out of med school.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, it really took me some years to start to find community. And so I'm so grateful to the folks who have been champions of my career, not just the mentors that I've had along the way that didn't look like me, by the way, but those people that have been sponsors for me and helped get me into spaces that I really had no exposure in prior. And so it really has been, even in my career time now, 15 years out of training, it's wonderful to go to our major society meetings and see more diverse trainees, you know, residents and fellows, folks that are interested in taking care of patients with brain cancer, because this is a disease that does not discriminate. And patients deserve to be able to see themselves reflected in the folks that are taking care of them. And so any win for diversity in neuro-oncology truly is a win for medicine and a win for our community in general.
I used the phrase cultural competence a few minutes ago. You know, not any given doctor could treat any given patient at any given time. Can you talk about what you mean by cultural competence when it comes to a doctor?
Yeah, it's such an important question that you ask, Rob, because when we think about cultural competence, I think for many of us, we consider it a checkbox. When it comes to different healthcare institutions, you know, some of the questions that might be asked, do you have chaplain support? Do you have language services? Those sorts of things to be able to care for people with different needs. And while cultural competence is what's accepted as really what the ideal should be, I like to challenge folks, and I like to think about the concept of cultural humility. The fact is, none of us can be experts in anyone else's culture other than our own. And so it's critically important that we treat one another with a sense of curiosity, recognizing that our experience is only that of our own, and that we have to be curious and ask the right questions of the folks that we're so privileged to share in the care of, to make sure that we're actually meeting their needs. We all come into the room and the patient encounter with an agenda per se. And so I'll say that nobody really has won or will have their agenda or heard, have their needs heard if we aren't curious and we don't first listen to one another. And so while cultural competence continues to be this phrase that we use in lots of different spaces, including within Elevate Med, we do know that when you have more diverse people around, it's better for everyone. It's not just better for patients as we think about patient care. It's better for the conversations that are happening in the workroom and the conversations that are happening in the cafeteria once we start to understand each other a little bit more, but still to be curious because no one has lived our experience other than ourselves.
Now, I'm not a doctor. I haven't gone through the training. I understand it's a lot of work, and not just in med school, but in continuing education. How do you make sure you find the time and the room for this kind of cultural competence training for people who have a lot on their plate already?
Yeah, you know, it really does have to be something that we're constantly dedicating ourselves toward. There's certainly opportunities through varied societies and organizations that physicians and healthcare folks that work in healthcare can be a part of, where different courses are offered for continuing medical education. But I would say that as we practice medicine every day, we have an opportunity to learn from every single person that we encounter. And that's one of the things that's beautiful about medicine. You get to take on this position of being a lifelong learner. And so every patient creates a new opportunity for me to work on that cultural humility, if you will. Every patient gives me the opportunity to fine-tune my listening and my understanding and communication. And so I try to put myself in a position of constantly being able to learn, because you're right, it's absolutely difficult to be able to find the time to take additional courses.
I wonder if you have thoughts for people out there who have been in that situation of being the patient and thinking, there's a cultural mismatch with my healthcare provider. I want to be heard and I don't feel like I am. Do you have thoughts on ways they can advocate for themselves in that position?
Yeah, I'll share kind of a trade secret. It's sometimes physicians are running late. They are multitasking, and unfortunately, sometimes they may not have the time to be able to pay attention to give the patient in front of them the attention they deserve. And so if a patient is ever on the other side of that, it's absolutely within their right to kind of ask the doctor for a timeout or a pause or just for a moment to and make that eye contact to ensure that that the physician is giving their full attention. And even after that, if you feel like you still aren't being heard, absolutely. The nice thing about healthcare is oftentimes we operate in teams. So there'll be somebody else in the room. There'll be a nurse available or even somebody at the desk who you might say, you know, I'm just not sure that I was able to get across what it is that is concerning me most. Because the most important thing is that your needs are met when you enter into a healthcare encounter. And if that's not happening with the provider that you've been assigned, certainly there are other opportunities for you to ensure that you're being heard and that your needs are being met.
And Dr. Porter, in just our last minute, I wonder if you could speak to, you know, maybe a high school student who's out there listening, thinking, I want to be a doctor, but I don't look like a doctor because of race or gender, or maybe their economic background, you name it. What would you say to encourage them?
Yeah. You know, it's the person that doesn't look like it that is exactly who we need. Sometimes I have the opportunity of being around young people and they say, oh, you know, I want to be an influencer. And I tell them, well, find a gap and fill it. And for any of us that don't look like the typical or don't come from a family lineage with a lot of physicians, you are exactly who we need. And so I would encourage them to continue to really work on their bravery and their resilience and their courage, because you need a lot of those skills in order to have this long career in medicine. And especially if you're plotting a new path and, you know, or maybe going in a different direction than what your, you know, family typically goes into. Those are all your experience, your perspective is exactly what's needed in our field, because, again, we deserve to have a workforce that really looks like the population that we take care of every day.
Dr. Porter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Alex Porter, a neuro-oncologist at Mayo Clinic. We talked with her about her work in shaping the next generation of physicians and the nonprofit she co-founded, Elevate Med, which works to increase diversity in the medical workforce. Last night, Governor Tony Evers introduced his third budget proposal to the Wisconsin State Legislature. It calls for almost $104 billion in spending over the next 2 years. It includes plans for what to do with the state's more than $7 billion surplus. In his address to lawmakers, the governor said that his plan offers opportunities for some bipartisan agreement.
Let's dispose of the notion that priorities in this budget are somehow extreme or far-fetched. I promise you this, in this budget, there's more that unites us and divides us. These aren't Republican or Democrat priorities, they're Wisconsin priorities, areas where we should be able to find common ground.
Mark Sommerhauser is communications director and policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob. It's good to be with you.
Big picture, what is your main takeaway from the governor's budget proposal?
Well, I guess the big picture would be that, this is a ambitious proposal, particularly when it comes to education, which we know is the governor's, really his absolute top priority. This is, we have a state budget process every 2 years in the state of Wisconsin, but this is going to be really a different process just by virtue of the fact that we have really an unprecedented state budget surplus heading into this 2 year budget cycle that's going to start July 1st. And that's really going to, I think, shape this budget process and make it quite different than some of the ones that we've seen previously. The governor is really seeing this as an opportunity, first and foremost, to increase funding for our schools here in Wisconsin. He's also proposed, additional funding for local governments, some tax cuts, and quite a few other things in his budget. So there's definitely a lot to unpack.
Before we dig into some of those more specific items, we heard the governor there saying, hey, there's common ground to be found. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss sort of agreed. Here's a listen to his part of his reaction.
I would say while there are some areas in Governor Evers' budget that I'm sure we will hope to find common ground on, our solutions are going to look dramatically different.
Do you see particular places, Mark, based on what we've heard from the governor and from leading Republicans, where we might expect to see them on the same page-ish as this budget develops?
Yeah, the ish is maybe an important qualifier there. But yeah, I think there are a few. Probably the one that comes to the top of the list in my mind would be the issue of state aid to local governments. We're talking here about our counties, cities, villages, and towns here in Wisconsin. Obviously, they provide a lot of the basic services that we expect from government, our local roads, parks, fire, police, planning and zoning and trash collection, all these kinds of things. And they have two main sources of funding, the local property taxes that property owners pay and aid that they get from the state. And in recent years, that state aid has come from a program called Shared Revenue. And the total funding for the Shared Revenue program has actually declined over the last 12 years. And that's not even taking into account inflation. When we add in inflation, it's really declined quite a bit. The governor is proposing in his budget to really do something quite different in this area. He is wanting to set aside 20% of the revenues that we get from our state's 5% sales tax to actually go to providing aid, state aid to local governments. So that would be something completely new, and it would result in a very large increase in state support for local governments, both up front. And then I think equally as important for local governments, it would create, an opportunity for the state aid that they receive to really increase with inflation over time, which it has not done over the last 10 to 15 years. I think there is some hope to think that there might be some room for agreement here between the governor and the legislative leadership, reason being that this idea actually first was kind of talked about publicly by the legislative leadership, this concept of setting aside a share of sales tax revenues for state aid to the locals. So that's one area that I would point to where certainly there's going to have to be some negotiation over that, but I think there's a potential for some bipartisan support.
Yeah, here's a listen to Governor Evers talking about that and alluding to adopting a Republican proposal on shared revenue.
Last month, I pledged my support for a budget provision to send 20% of the state's sales tax revenue back to our local communities for shared revenue. And I'm excited to share that our budget includes that proposal. I don't care where it came from, providing more than $500 million more per year in new resources to invest in key priorities like public safety. We have to get this done, folks.
Mark, shared revenue can sound like an abstract government concept, but it seems like with that prospect for working together on it, this seems like something you could sell to both parties, right? This is your roads and this is your local police department and first responders. Does that make it something you see as making it more likely that we could see cooperation here?
Well, I'll just say from my standpoint, the first time I heard about this concept was actually, not in the governor's budget address, but it was at a forum event that we had last month. Our organization hosts public events periodically, and we had an event last month where one of our guests was Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. And that was the first time I had heard a state leader kind of talk about this idea of setting aside the 20% of sales tax revenue. So, that is certainly a promising starting point, and to hear both the Assembly Speaker and the governor talking about this concept. There are other elements of the governor's proposal that I think may be a little more contentious. He's also talking about giving local governments the authority to collect new sales taxes if, crucial to note, if their voters in that county or that municipality would approve them, they would need to be subject to referendum. But his proposal would allow Milwaukee County to do an additional 1% sales tax. Other counties, and other municipalities would be able to do an additional 0.5%, again, subject to a voter referendum. I think that piece of his proposal potentially is going to be a harder sell in the legislature since we're talking about additional taxes. But going back to the piece of 20% of state sales tax revenue going to local governments, certainly that's an area that seems promising.
Talking to Mark Sommerhauser from Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at the governor's budget address last night and where the Democratic governor and Republican-led legislature agree and or disagree. One point of a tiny bit of agreement and more disagreement, I think, Mark, is taxes. The governor is saying, hey, let's have a 10% tax cut for people making less than $100,000 a year. Joint filers make less than $150,000. Republicans seem to be coming together around a flat income tax rate of 3.25%, meaning upper income people would join in the tax cut here. Seems like it might be harder to find common ground on this one.
Yeah, I would agree. I think this issue of taxes is going to be one of the defining issues of this budget, because along probably with education and with this issue of state aid to local governments, the tax issue is one where I think it's pretty fair to say that that's the top issue for legislative Republicans, is doing a very large tax cut. I think we've heard the word transformational used by some of the legislative leaders. They see with such an unprecedented surplus a really, you know, once in a generation opportunity to do tax relief. The governor has also proposed tax cuts. So both sides want to do tax cuts. The debate is going to be about how big of a cut to do and who is going to receive the bulk of the relief in tax cuts. You know, the governor is, broadly speaking, targeting his proposed tax cuts toward working class and middle class Wisconsinites. Meanwhile, the flat, you mentioned the flat income tax proposal, just as a bit of context, right now our state has what's called a progressive income tax, in which the tax rates increase by the taxpayer's income. They start at 3.54% at the lowest income levels, up to 7.65% for those at the highest incomes. The proposal that we've heard from Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux, we know a lot of other Republican lawmakers support it, is to shift to a single tax rate for all incomes of 3.25%. And so, you know, the consequence of that going from our current system to that system would be that the bulk of relief would go to the wealthiest Wisconsinites. Senator Lemieux and some of the other proponents are saying this would be something that would make Wisconsin more competitive with other states that don't tax higher incomes as highly as Wisconsin does. But, you know, that kind of sets up a pretty sharp contrast. In addition, of course, the flat tax proposal would be a very large reduction in overall tax collections in the state of Wisconsin. It would, over the next 2 years, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau is estimating it would reduce tax collections by about $4.9 billion over the two-year period. The plan would phase in, so that amount kind of increases, and the further you go out by year four, it would decrease tax collections by about $5 billion each year. So that would be, you know, that would certainly be a big impact going forward in terms of the state's overall tax collections.
And you've mentioned education, the governor calling for a fairly big increase in education spending. Here's a listen.
Tonight, I'm calling on the legislature to join me in doing what's best for our kids by approving the largest increase in K-12 schools and education in our state's history.
Mark, I think there'll be disagreement on the amount of money and the kind of schools that get any increased funding. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, I think that's right, Rob. I think, you know, the amount that the governor is proposing in terms of increased funding for education, $2.6 billion, is really quite a large number. We know, again, this is really the governor's top priority. and, you know, most of that funding would go really to two places. It would go about $1 billion would go toward the state's general equalization aid formula, which is the main way that the state provides aid to school districts. That's a formula that is meant to sort of equalize disparities in property wealth between different school districts. Obviously, we know there are big differences from one school district to another in their property tax base. And that formula is meant to provide more state aid to districts that are poorer in property wealth and less aid to the wealthier districts. So more than $1 billion would go to that. More than $1 billion in additional funding would go to special education. That's an area where Wisconsin's, you know, current reimbursement rate for the amount of state dollars that the state gives to offset the cost of special education right now to districts statewide is about 30%. That reimbursement rate under the governor's proposal, that would go up to about 60%. So that, those are kind of the two biggest pieces in the governor's proposal. I think it's fair to say that Republicans are likely to balk at the overall price tag of this proposal. There seems to be some openness to increase funding for schools, but at the level of $2.6 billion, I think is unlikely to get support from the legislature. And then the other piece you mentioned, Rob, yeah, I mean, there's no question a huge part of the disagreement here is going to be how we treat the choice program that also is known by some as the school voucher program. The governor wants to freeze enrollment in that program starting in the 24-25 school year. I think that's going to be a non-starter with the legislature, which, you know, really has the opposite view about school choice. They want to expand school choice, not freeze it. So, you know, that's going to be clearly another point of contention.
Mark, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Mark Sommerhauser with Wisconsin Policy Forum looking at the governor's budget address last night. We'll be tackling a lot of the pieces of that budget in the weeks and months to come.